Hey, this is Michael Emery. Thanks for tuning into the Slow Baja. This podcast is powered by Tequila Fortaleza, handmade in small batches and hands down my favorite tequila.
Slow Baja is brought to you by the Baja XL Rally. The Baja XL is the largest and longest amateur off-road rally on the Baja Peninsula. It's 10 epic days, LA to Cabo to LA. Check it out at bajaxl.org.
We're here in La Jolla with Eve Ewing.
Well, we're in North University City. It says Playmore, La Jolla, but the funny joke is we're on the wrong side of the freeway.
Well, you've said that so many times to me already, and I hardly know you. It's a pretty darn nice spot, though.
You're damn right. We have a family of coyotes that live there, and I remember one year there were five deer went up that little gravel slope. But the deer are pretty much gone now. But when I first moved here, there wasn't a single building over there or any of these up here. It was a wonderful kind of wild spot still. But we still have coyotes, and I love it. I'm surrounded by brush on three sides, which means I'll probably burn any year now. But Hey, Jerry, hi. How's it going?
We're outside of Eve's residence here, and she's got her beautiful dogs, and I'm having a Modelo, a Negro Modelo, which is so kind, and Eve's having a glass of rosé. And, well, we're just going to jump right into it because we're on a time limit here. Eve's got some things to do. So how did you become the queen of burro outfitting in Baja?
Well, you know, if you pick a place to go where very few people want to go and there aren't any maps, and there aren't any roads, and you find it's singularly pleasant to find that you're important simply because you went someplace that no one else has been for a while. It's really kind of funny. Anyway, Andy Melling was the one that put the mule trip together that I was on.
And that's 1963.
The thing that was so different in those days is there really weren't any. There was the auto club map. There were some aerial maps for pilots, and they had no roads or anything on them. And we never knew on that trip. Andy said from the day one, he said, you know, we don't know. We may run into some rancher at some point on this trip, and he'll say, you know what? The next water hole south is 3.5 days. And we'd have to turn around and go home.
And that trip, we're talking about the 1963 to 1964 to
Cabo San Lucas Melling Alford expedition.
Joanne Alford.
Joanne Alford and Andy Melling from the Melling Ranch. Right, right. And I got to be on that trip from Bahia de Los Angeles to La Paz.
And your father flew you down. He was a pilot, private pilot, and oceanographer, right?
Yes, he's an oceanographer. He did research from his airplane. He studied the lagoons. And in fact, my father is known as, this is really kind of a funny story. You've probably heard of Continental Drift.
Yes, I've heard of the Continental Drift.
Of course. Well, one of the famous people of Continental Drift is a man named Maurice Ewing from Woods Hole. And my father is Gifford Ewing. And at that time, this is before he got to do his famous stuff. So what he did when he was teaching at Scripps, he would say, you know what? I'm going to give an A to any of you guys that'll go up to Maurice Ewing in Woods Hole and say, are you by any chance related to the famous Gifford Ewing at Scripps Oceanographic? My father was a very funny man. But my father's known as the father of oceanography from space. And after my mother died in 64 and he moved to Woods Hole, he joined up with NASA and he was with MIT part of the time too. And what he did, he was fascinated at studying particularly the currents and things that you could see around Cape Cod and from the air and everything when he was flying back there. And he was fascinated with currents and patterns in the water. And so what he did was hook up with NASA. And he said, you know what we need to do is to start to put some temperature buoys out into the ocean so we know what's going on out there. And those temperature buoys, which he finally got NASA to agree to do, and they, of course, measured the instruments from I guess they're going around and around the world, Earth. Those instruments are the beginning of our understanding about El Nino.
You moved to La Jolla in 1945, I read.
Yes.
Interesting time.
1945. Yes. My father was in the... volunteered to be in the Navy in World War II because he knew how to navigate. He spent his childhood in Maine. He lived in Poughkeepsie, New York, but he spent his childhood in Maine in the summertime. So he learned how to navigate and sail. And the Navy was desperate in World War II to get anybody, so they put him on in a converted yacht and sent him out into the Atlantic to try and sink German submarines. Yeah, please. That's how desperate we were.
Crazy.
And he nearly died of pneumonia off of Portsmouth, Maine. And it was his third time for pneumonia. His brother had died of pneumonia in World War I, and he nearly died in World War II. They pulled him through, and they said, hey, we need you. You can navigate. You know stuff. And so we're going to send you to San Diego. And so before that, we were living on a dairy farm, in Dutchess County, New York, but it wasn't our main income. I would say my father was a gentleman farmer.
Gentleman farmer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what was it like when you moved to San Diego? You were 10 years old?
I was 8, turned 9 shortly after I got here.
What was that like? The bright sun, the blue ocean?
It was, I was in a state of grief because I found out we were not going to be going back. And you know, whatever piece of country you're born into, like we Dutchess County, New York, the farm we lived on, whatever part of land I think that you're born into and are raised maybe the first 7-8 years of your life, it's a part of your life forever. It's just part of your life forever. Would you rather sit there and put your back to the...
I'm going to just move over to this seat because I am right into the sun. But.
Yeah, no, that's no fun. And so I love the forest. I love walking into a woods and hearing the wood thrush, which is a bird that has that beautiful lilt, that sort of beautiful song. And you could never see it because of all the leaves in the forest, but you could hear it. It was magical. And fireflies. My sister and I used to sneak out our windows on top of the house and crawl and sneak out on top of the roof. No, our parents, of course, didn't know. And look at the fireflies in the woods. Just
no
loved.
No fireflies here in California.
None.
You're
none.
Not going to see that.
So it was such a shock. So when I got here, I was in grief for what I knew. But what gradually happened was I fell in love with space and distance and silence. And very soon after we got out here, we met the people that owned the Penasquitos Ranch, and Russell and Florence Peavy sort of became my godparents. And whenever I could run away from home and go out and live on the original Penasquitos, which was the original Spanish land grant in all of California, I did. At that point, the Peavys had bought it from the Saudi and Sexton Corporation, which was a big cattle ranching outfit in San Diego. They owned the Penasquitos, they owned the Wahita, they owned the Cuyamaca Ranch, they owned the San Felipe Ranch in the desert, they owned Santa Maria, which you may have heard of it before, it's called Ramona. They owned whatever. But I mean, they and the Dailies were the big cattle ranching companies in San Diego. Anyway, long story short, we bought a horse from him at a rodeo and went to pick it up, and we met the family in Rose Canyon that owned the San Clemente Canyon Ranch. And they later bought the Penasquitos from after George Saudi and Oliver Sexton died, their daughters that lived in Witch Creek, were a little bit overwhelmed. So anyway, the Peavies bought the Penasquitas from him, and that's where my playground was as a child. It's where I learned to ride on country and hold cattle, hold herd, and stuff like that.
Yeah, so you were a real cowgirl, honestly. You were moving some cattle. I learned
how not to be a problem.
Yeah.
And how to hold herd and not be a problem. Like never try and stand downhill from a bull. Always stand uphill from a bull. They will charge you downhill, they will never charge you uphill. Things that came in handy when I was in Baja and was invited to join the big cattle roundups down there, which were really like paintings from Russell and paintings of the way. I couldn't believe what I was looking at when I got invited to see those in the wild mule roundups that I got invited to see.
And can you tell me about, do you remember your first trip to Baja? About what year
that
might have been?
It was in the back of my dad's plane when he initiated the first census of the California gray whale. And he did it from his airplane, and he took with him alternately Carl Hubbs, which was the most famous of all of the people at Scripps, Carl Hubbs, Ray Gilmore, and Ted Walker. And these were the ichthyologists, but it was mostly Carl Hubbs. And what they did is they flew over Scammon's Lagoon every year from the time they started this in the early 50s until the mid-60s, I think, when my mother died. And they would fly on the same day of the year. They would fly over the same leads into the lagoon, and the cows, of course, would come into the shallow lagoons where the water was warmer, and they could have their calves, and they would be safe there. And the reason it was called Scammon's Lagoon is because Scammon, a famous whaler, the other whalers out in the Pacific there, they couldn't figure out where he disappeared. And he disappeared, and he came out with whale blubber. And what? And they couldn't figure out. It was a very narrow bottleneck into Scammon's Lagoon. You had to go through the surf and the whole thing. And he would wait until it was foggy when nobody could follow him. And so they did figure out where he was going. But Scammon's, and that's why it's called Scammon's Lagoon. And I'm starting to think if Scammon was a Spaniard or a Portuguese, I don't remember. But
so your first trip to Baja, about what year?
My first trip to Baja was
about what year was that in the plane?
53, probably 54, maybe something like
and
that.
And how much time did you spend on the ground?
We would land at this was the fun thing. We would land in a salt flat out in Guerrero Negro, which means, as you know, that means the Black Warrior, and it was named after a British frigate ship that robbed the Spanish galleons whenever it could get a chance. And it was just this salt flat we would land into. And there were, I think, 5 Quonset huts. And it was a company, the salt company was began by a Scottish, English company. And then the Mexican government moved in and took part of it. And that was the beginning of Guerrero Negro. I don't know when was the last time you were in Guerrero Negro.
I was just there in, I guess, January of 2019.
Okay. Imagine, 5 Quonset huts. That's it.
Wow.
And so it was on a trip with a dad. And, oh no, let me think. My first trip. Oh, yes. And then he would fly over... he'd fly over the lagoons, and then he would go into Los Angeles Bay for the evening, and Antero Diaz was a good friend of his. In fact, Dad got the first shortwave radio into Antero Diaz in LA Bay, which was very isolated, and Mexican government would not allow the Mexicans to have a shortwave radio on land, so Antero Diaz said, oh, well, that's no problem. I'll put it on my boat, the San Agustin. And, well, of course he didn't. It was in his office, you know, inside on land. But if you called him, it would be San Augustine, San Augustine, San Augustine, KNX 10, you know, do all that shortwave talk. And that's how Dad would communicate. But he got him that radio, and it saved a lot of people's lives and things like that. But, okay, so we're flying in from Scammon's Lagoon one time, and when I was just with my dad, and he wasn't with anyone when he wasn't with anyone else, and the wheels wouldn't go down. Only there's a word for the proper word. Oh, honey, no, those are our nice neighbors. Honey, you're such a terrorist. Listen to her. Hi. Okay. Anyway, Sugar Bear. Yeah, he's good. They're all being good. Dad said, "Oh, the wheels won't go down." So he handed me a broom handle, and he said, "Unscrew the plate there, and please push the wheels down." So I had to push the wheels down in my dad's plane, which was a converted Grumman Widgeon, and that would land on the water or land on the land. So it's things like that that you're like, "Okay, Dad." And then Antero, if the winds were blowing bad, Antero would call, "Hey, Gif, he said. He'd say, "You be careful. The winds are bad down here. I'm going to get my chicken coop if you don't be careful." And he always said he wanted the first plane that crashed in the field used to be in the middle of town. Now it's out at Gringo Point or someplace else. But it used to be in the middle of town. So if you wanted to land. But I think what touched me so much about my first trip was how amazingly wild it was, even from the air. And I think what touched me so was I knew, even from the air, I was looking at land that had never been messed with the ideas and plans of human beings. It was just wild. It was theirs. It belonged to theirs. In fact, one of the most poignant experiences I remember ever having was going, this was one on my 50 mule trips long after the Melling trip, and my co-explorer, my friend Mark Robin, we went into an area where the guide said, "You know, this frightens me here because there's hardly ever any water in here." And it was right after Chubasco, and there are mountain ranges in Baja you cannot go into until they've had a Pacific Chubasco hurricane come in and dump a bunch of water. And he was a little bit uneasy. And I've never had the experience before, and I wasn't until years later that I found my friend Mark had the same experience. We were riding maybe 50, 75 feet apart, exploring on our own from our base camp. And I couldn't believe what came out of my mouth. What came out of my mouth was, I know I'm not supposed to be here, but I'm doing no harm, and I honor you, and I didn't know what I was saying or why. And it was one of those places that has never been messed with the hands and deeds of man. And I cannot tell you what an extraordinary experience that is.
I can feel it. I can feel it and see it in your eyes.
Yeah. Just,
you can't make that up.
No. And years later, I found Mark had had the same experience. We were in an area where something else was in control. And I'm a scientist's daughter, so I don't believe in all this kind of fuzzy stuff. But that happened again to me at a rock art site called Montevideo outside of L.A. Bay. I went there with Liesl Munoz, who I was mentioning the other day. Liesl and I went out to the Montevideo rock art site, and this was in the days when it was still pretty rough to get out there. But we were out there, and we camped overnight, and the next day we went there, and she climbed up on a rock to take a photograph of what looked like a abstract form of a female yoni. You know what that is, a female genitalia, which is very common in rock art.
I'm a married man.
You're very common in rock art. It looked like a Judy Chicago plate is what it looked like.
Okay.
And interesting painting. And Liesl, we met after, and I went further up the creek. And I don't know what, then there was just like a feeling of wind or something, and I was looking at an art panel, and all I just, it just came out of my mouth automatically. I said, please, I mean no harm. I hear you. I know you're here. I am respectful of you and thank you. I don't know where that came from. And Liesl comes down later, and she comes back down from the rock ledge where she was taking a picture, and her eyes were as big as saucers. And she said, you know, I was told I shouldn't be here. I should not be here. And I said, what the hell's happening? And I told her what happened to me, and we were like, what? And I don't know, I just know from an experiential way that when the human spirit gets to the edge of what is known and what is unknown, which is the wilderness edge, it's a profound experience. And I don't care whether it's the Greeks' myth of the Iliad. What was with that famous Greek the tales from the, you know, the
Homer
Iliad
and the Odyssey.
Iliad, yeah. And the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Or that was the Greek edge of the world. The Norse tales from
the Vikings.
The Vikings. Paul Bunyan and his blue ox. I don't know. But it seems like wilderness, which is that place, I know what's behind, I know everything in here, but I don't know what's on that mountain in the distance. I've never been there. I don't know what's over this hill here. And I can remember the days when the Sierra Santa Clara were considered to be the most mysterious place because none of us had ever been out there. And those are the mountain ranges that stick up in the middle, the Vizcaino Desert out between Scammon's Lagoon and, I don't know, where the antelope are. But that to me was so poignant. The wilderness, and so it helps me understand. When I study Indian cave paintings, which has been my passion really for the last 50 years, I just want to listen. I want to listen to what they're trying to say. That's what's important to me. Not my ideas about what they're trying to say. What are they trying to say?
And so on that, you made the trip with Andy Melling and Joanne, and there was supposed to be some cave painting. Had you ridden in Baja previous to that? No. So that's 1963-64.
No,
that's
I've been on pack trips in this High Sierra with my family, and I'd ridden on the Penasquitos Ranch and did a lot of riding there, but no. Nothing.
So,
Baja California, it's unbelievably rugged.
And your father said, you know what, Eve, you should go with this. Well, you should go. Half the people just left. You should go.
Well, he radioed me. He said, Eve, there's some people in Los Angeles Bay. Well, here's the funny thing. You want to know what's funny? When Dad told me, he said, there's some people here from the Melling Ranch who have ridden in from Tecate, and a whole bunch of their people are pulling out of this expedition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You must say why.
Well, I found out why later, but that's okay. They need some new people to come. Do you want to go? And I said, yeah, sure. Well, what I had figured out at that point is that somebody knew what they were doing. Because I think it was the Los Angeles Times that had interviewed Joanne Alford, who was Andy's, the one that I mentioned, who was the space aeronautics beauty queen from Boeing.
So a beautiful woman.
A beautiful, lovely, lovely lady. Okay. And a very, very slight, very quiet, very, it's amazing. It's kind of like Trudy. Trudy is such a lady and so gracious, and she has grit in her soul and in her being that is just extraordinary. But she handles everything with such grace, such grace. It's just extraordinary. Well, anyway, Joanne was a little bit like that. She'd never seen the back or front end of a mule, but she and Andy kind of fell in love, and she'd go down to the Melling Ranch whenever she could get off work and blah, blah, blah. And they planned this expedition. Andy said, all my life I've wanted to do a mule trip down Baja. The cowboys tell me you can do it, but none of them have been south of Laguna Chapala at that point. I don't think they had, but... And so they put this expedition together. So the newspaper interviewed her, and they said, Miss Alford, what are you going to do if you can't find water? And in the article it said, well, I'm going to look for yellow jackets and follow the yellow jackets. And I thought, I was enough of a biologist to know, these people are going to die. What are they doing? They didn't interview Andy Melling. They interviewed Joanne. They're going to follow yellow jackets. So this was the group that had arrived in L.A. Bay, and I said to myself, somebody on that trip knows what's going on. And I had never been to the Melling Ranch before at that point. Somebody knows what's going on. And that was that magnificent man, Andy Melling. A quiet, gentle man, chain smoker, tequila drinking, good, kind, hearted, decent man. And he's the one who knew what was going on. And it was, and his family had begged him not to make that trip that year because it had not rained down that peninsula in the center for 5 years.
Wow.
When we got into Tacho Arce's ranch, Rancho Esperanza, where Harry
Crosby's friend.
Yeah, that was outside of San Ignacio. He said, it has not rained here for, oh my God, it's not rained here for 6 years.
Here at Slow Baja, we can't wait to drive our old Land Cruiser south of the border. And when we go, we'll be going with Baja Bound Insurance. Their website's fast and easy to use. Check them out at BajaBound.com. That's BajaBound.com, serving Mexico travelers since 1994. Hey, Baja tourism is picking up, and our friends at the Animal Pad and TAP Act want to remind you when you're crossing the border, just say no to puppy peddlers. I know they're cute, but the sooner we can end the demand, we can end the supply. For more information, check out theanimalpad.org and TAP Act on Instagram and Facebook. My recent guest, Trudy Angel, has made a beautiful documentary film, and she is a couple weeks and a couple of $1,000 away from having that thing broadcast ready. She is soliciting donations, and I am trying to help her out. So if you have anything left in the tank, please consider making a small donation. You can send funds at tourloreto@aol.com. That is tourloreto@aol.com, T-O-U-R. LOREETO@AOL.com. And if you have any questions, you can also reach Trudy Angel at that email address and talk to her about how to make that contribution tax deductible, etc. Thank you very much for your help. Yeah. You jumped on a mule in Bahia de Los Angeles. They had contacted your father at some point to say.
Okay, so Francisco Munoz came and picked me up.
And you had a shopping list, as I understand.
Oh, yes. I had many pounds of horseshoe nails, so many 50. Pounds of dehydrated eggs, and they told me to get tapaderos put on my saddle. Do you know what those are?
No.
Those are the leather coverings in front of a stirrup to keep the bushes from scratching you in the cactus. Get tapadero, bring your saddle,
tapaderos.
Bring your tapadero, bring your sleeping bag and a duffel bag. And
Francisco came to pick you up?
Francisco Munoz came to pick me up in San Diego and fly me down. Yeah. And because Dad and Francisco were really good friends. One of the funnest stories Francisco has on my dad is my dad had a tire go flat, and it was the stub on a tire. What is that? The valve. The tire valve. And so he was getting ready to have the man from San Diego Air, what was his name? He was a Peruvian man, come down and bring him a tire and stuff. And Francisco said, Geef, he said, I can fix this for you. You know, Mexican is wonderful. They can fix anything with
anything
a rubber band,
need.
A piece of wire, and a pair of pliers. And they said, no, Geef, don't worry. We can fix this right away. So what he did was take a rubber band. They filled the tire up with air. And then they filled the tire up with air. And then he took a rubber band and put it tight around the valve where it was leaking a bit. And Dad took off.
Perfect solution on your airplane.
Perfect.
What the heck?
What, you darn right.
What could go wrong?
How many?
Wait till I somehow.
How many Francisco Muñoz stories are there like that? Seriously, Eve, let's get on to those donkeys. You flew to Bahia de Los Angeles.
Okay, I get down there and I
half the folks had left, or more than half had left.
Half the people are left.
It hasn't rained in 6 years.
Yeah, and we're starting to go south. And Dick
Where's
Daggett,
the ominous music?
Well, Dick.
There should be ominous music playing right now.
Well, okay. Dick Daggett.
That's a great name.
Dick Daggett's father jumped ship.
Yes.
And became one of the German Baja families, like Fisher and San Ignacio,
yes.
Dick Daggett in Los Angeles Bay. And his father jumped ship, and he was the son. And he
jumped ship in the 17
whatts,
18
right,
whatts,
right.
A couple hundred years before you got there.
Absolutely. And he wanted so much to come with us, and he couldn't because he was just too old. But he got some revenge. He got his revenge. He knew I was the new gringo. I was the greenhorn coming on to this trip. He didn't know that I had some riding and ranching experience, but nevertheless, I was the greenhorn. Please, if you want to start with
Moscato. No. I'm fine.
It's
thank
Moscato,
you.
Moscato, not...
Not rosé?
Not rosé.
We're not getting technical here on the Slow Baja podcast.
Well, you're welcome. Here's a whole extra cup for you.
Eve is worrying about me because I just drank the rest, the end of my Modelo. I'm getting nervous. We've got 15 more minutes here, so I want to get these.
How did I get started? Okay. So
you're the new gringa.
I'm the new gringa. So
Dick Daggett's worried about you.
I'm just mounting up on my mule. We're getting ready to leave, and Dick Daggett can't come, and he's brokenhearted. And who we had was Romero, what was his first name? The man that led Earl Stanley Gardner south on through the old wagon road when the first time they drove the old wagon road by car. And anyway, so he was going to take us, and he carried his rifle across his shoulder like that, and off we went. But before that, Dick Daggett came up to me. He says, years ago, he said, I'd run burros from the Pacific coast into the mine here and Punta Penasco to Puerto something or other. I didn't remember what it was. And he said, there's only one water hole in between there. And one time I come in, it's getting close to dark. And he said, there's something funny going on, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And as usual, the burros go faster than I go. And they get in there. And they start mucking up the water. But I managed to get my canteens filled before they really mucked it up. But I just didn't remember that rock in the middle of that Tinaja. And the water went down and down as all my burros kind of drank water. And then he looked at me and he said, and then guess what? That rock in the middle of the Tinaja, it had a horn. It wasn't a rock. It was a dead cow. And so the only water I had for the next 2 days is now a dead cow has died in this Tinaja. And so he said, and then he looked at me because he wanted to make sure I was suffering. And he looked at me and he says, I poured that water through my hat and I filled my hat full of sand and I boiled it. I did everything I could do. And then he looked at me to make sure I was looking at him when he said, you know what? It still tasted like an old dead cow. And 5 minutes later, I began to ride on the Melling expedition for the next 4 months. And
wow.
Yeah. We drank out of a lot of water holes that had dead animals in it, I can promise you. And in those days, Giardia hadn't hit yet.
So you slept in the dirt on a saddle or on the saddle blanket.
Saddle, slept
under the stars.
Yeah, in those days we didn't have those air pillows or whatever it is.
Yeah,
people
yeah,
live
yeah.
On.
None of those niceties.
Saddle blankets, and then to
you didn't,
they
you did
had
not
no
fit
tents.
Yourself at the REI before you
no,
went.
No, they didn't have an REI, and but they had these can't. What he had was enormous canvas tarps. And those were put up on top of his mule. He had pack mules, not pack burros. And in some cases, the country was not suitable for mules. It was only suitable for burros, as what happened when one of our mules fell off the mountain. Its pack hit the rock, and it rolled off. But
There were some
Andy
hardships.
Was the man
there were some
who
hardships
knew.
On that. What? There were some hardships on that.
Oh
trip.
My God!
Lost a mule to a mountain lion. I understand. One of those
yes,
hungry
never
mountain lions.
I'll never forget that part. But Andy Milling, he's the man who knew the country, and he's the man that knew mules. And because it hadn't rained for 5 years, and his family begged him to postpone that trip, but he didn't. So in order for the mules to get something to eat, now you could never camp at a water hole because everything around a water hole for a day's journey has been eaten up by the cattle, what starving cattle are left. So you had to camp between the water hole that you just filled up on and the water hole that you were going to and camp in the middle. And then what Andy would do for his animals to be able to get enough to eat is, and you couldn't even hobble them. And after it took about 3 weeks before his mules tried to go back to the Milling Ranch, they had some tough times. They had some really tough times. Kathy Barton, who was on the trip, who later married Andy, divorced her husband, who was a Navy helicopter pilot, married Andy. She said, you know, for that month between Tecate and Los Angeles Bay, the north wind never stopped. And she said, you could either pull your jacket up and keep your neck warm, and it would then get down and
your lower back would freeze.
And then you could pull your jacket down, keep your back warm, and it would get you in the back of the neck. And then trying to cook at night when the wind would never stop. It would never stop. And she said, we were all so exhausted. And I think that's why a lot of those people just said, this is not for us. And they had two photographers from Brooks
Institute.
Santa Barbara. Photographers from Brooks Institute. And one taking film and one taking slides. And they left. They'd had it. And so when I came in, I was just the fresh meat. And
hey, fresh meat, tell me something a little bit. You just mentioned Brooks. You studied at the Art Institute.
Yeah, San Francisco.
So my Baja Artists. Friends don't give a rat's ass about the Art Institute, but you were there with some luminaries.
Oh.
And it's right outside of my living room window.
Okay, I will never forget. Okay.
So first, give me 2 minutes on that. Just okay, two, and then we're back, to okay. We're back to Burroughs and
no,
Baja.
No, that's fine. We can play. We can play. I was so lucky because I had Minor White.
Yeah. Hello.
For my teacher.
Holy Toledo.
Minor White sent us home after the first day or two of class.
About what year is this? Excuse me for asking. I understand you're about 84?
I'm 84. That would have been, I think, in the late 60s, I think. I'm not. I'll have to think about that.
Okay.
Because then I also took a course from Ansel Adams in Yosemite.
Yeah.
But Minor White was the man. He was the teacher. He said, all right, I want you kids to go home, and I want you here at 6 in the morning, and your assignment is to take a photograph of light. And what he tried to tell us was that light is the soul of photography. And he was a Zen Buddhist, too, so he got into all this stuff. And I'll never forget, I was up on Telegraph Hill at sunrise, and the light coming on the streetcar things and this and that and what and what. He was right. Trying to take a photograph of light was the whole story. It was amazing. And then we also had Imogene Cunningham.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
was a character. She was a character. I didn't learn
solid
much from
citizen.
Her. Minor White's the one I
but
learned
But she
from.
Would have been about in her 80s or 90s by
she
then.
She was no spring chicken.
Yeah.
Now I'm wondering if you would be better off in that.
No,
well,
I'm fine.
Oh,
I'm
shoot.
Fine. We're
oh,
we're staying right
Wind's
here.
Wind's going this way. We're not going to catch each
other. Don't worry
stuff.
About me, Eve.
And Imogene Cunningham, she was wonderful. And then we had one of the Westons. But then then I had a chance to go and take a photography course from Ansel Adams in Yosemite, and that is his summer course, and learned the zone system. And the way he taught us was you had to have some camera with a Polaroid back. Well, I had a speed graphic, and so I could pull the back off. And he taught us the basic thing, which is you expose for shadow and develop for highlights. That's what we learned. That's the basic zone system, right?
I just wish kids knew that when they were shooting with their phones these days.
Oh,
Expose for the shadow, develop for the highlight.
Right.
It's the way I learned.
Yeah, yeah. So you learned the zone system,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sure.
Where did you learn it?
It's harder when you shot, you know, I shot journalism and sports and with a motor drive, so you're not really able to put that into practice so much. But you do look at, you know, if you're going to overexpose the roll a little bit or underdevelop it or overdevelop it or what have you. So, and now I shoot a 4x5 for fun in the summertime.
You know, just for fun?
Handheld.
You're wonderful.
I use an old Graflex Super D that has the big pop-up viewfinder.
Wonderful.
So it's a terrific camera. But we're not talking cameras. We're talking about you and Baja, so let's get right back to it. Anyway. So you jumped off the Melling Ranch.
The Bahia de Los Angeles
trip.
LA.
We're not going to go into the details of that, but it seems like the mules got under your skin.
Yes,
or was it Baja
I
that got under your
them.
Skin,
well,
or was it the cave paintings that you really didn't get a
I'll
chance
tell
to
you
see
what
them
got
all?
Under my skin was the land. I'll never forget, south of La Alay Bay, maybe 2 days' ride south, we passed an old abandoned ranch called Rancho La Fortuna, and that's where a mountain lion killed our biggest mule. And Andy was upset because he had sent Ramon out, what was his last name? Ramon out to bring the mules back, and he said, he came back, his eyes were big as saucers. He said one of the mules had been killed. And I think it was before Ramon got back, Joanne Alford, bless her heart, she went to the bathroom and came back and said, Andy, what's about this high and has a long tail and little round ears? Andy jumped, I swear, if you could jump straight up and down off the ground, he jumped as far as a man could do out of there. And he grabbed his rifle or his gun and he said, everybody come back to the camp. It was years later that we found out that this was a very famous mountain lion. And what it had done was to kill our biggest mule and drag it about 50 feet.
So it was a serious mountain lion.
It was a serious mountain lion.
And it was a seriously hungry mountain lion.
And what was wonderful is I never realized it at the time, but the mountain lion stories were all about the transition gradually between when nature had control of the environment that you're in, and you eventually begin to get control over nature. But that story, every time we went to a further ranch south, they had heard about the mountain lion, they heard about the story, and we had to tell them the story. And what I realized is that in that very process, I was living in the extraordinary experience of creating another mythology. That mountain lion became bigger and bigger as you went south. You know, it became bigger. Actually, it was a big mountain lion. They found out later it was a huge mountain lion. Took the Via Vicencio cattle, their burros, everything. And it was a famous mountain lion. And years later, Andy found the hoof and the shoe of the mule that it had killed. And he brought it to me because it was in... Oh, not Andy, Arturo Villavicencio's country. But that fascinated me. I didn't realize it took me years later to realize this is what mythology is all about. And then as the years go by, the story... Okay, so here's the story where everybody's eyes are as big as saucers. This mountain lion is big. He's big, and he took this biggest mule ever. And then you hear stories... then my guide... Corazon Vaquero, when he talks about trying to go in and kill a mountain lion and it jumps over his head and it scares him to pieces, he says, oh, and I'm so scared. So then you have the stories where the mountain lion and the human being are kind of 50-50. They got an equal chance, okay? And then it progresses from that to building a fire and destroying the mountain lion, or with dynamite and downing the cave that it's in. So little by little, man becomes the big predator. And it changes. What the series of mountain lion stories are to me are the progression of a time when the wilderness The song of the wild was wilder than the song of man. And little by little, the song of man becomes the powerful story. And there's no, and now they just put poison out or whatever they can get away from. The government can't catch them putting poison out, you know, or whatever they do. And it's a different world now. But that was such an amazing experience. And what it's important to me about is it gives me some teeny little tiny ability to put my feet close to the side of, not in the moccasins, but near the moccasins of the Indians that painted those paintings. And what were they trying to say? That I wanted to know.
That we don't know. And that's going to be the subject for our next podcast.
Well, we're getting, when we have clues.
When I get
we
back to
clues.
Talk to you again, yeah. And we get on to the rest of your multiple trips to Baja and the cave paintings.
But I'm really very lucky and blessed to have had this opportunity. And it's one of those things where it took, it took years, decade or more, to begin to filter down what is it that I really, really happened. I'll never forget the day when I slept on the ground and I felt, if I sleep on this ground one more night, I'm going to become the dirt of the earth. And I had to sleep on it one more time. And that was really important. If you've ever read Davison, what was her first name? Davison's book about crossing from Alice Springs to the Indian Ocean on
with
camel.
The camel, yes. From Alice to Ocean.
Yeah, from Alice to Ocean, yeah. I remember having that similar experience, that feeling that I was going to turn into the earth. And what you start with when you go down there, and I'm scientist's daughter, so you start there with left brain solving everything. And what begins to happen is, you don't know it, but there's an evolutionarily important reason we have a right brain. And the right brain is what takes you into the wilderness and lets you know when there's a mountain lion coming behind you and your eyes can't see it, but you know it's coming.
You can sense it.
You know it's coming.
You can sense it.
And so it was a tremendous transition to know. And then the same, that Davison talked about the same thing. And then when she got back to civilization, what she found is little by little by little, the only thing that really works in the city is the left brain. But out there, the right brain, and the right brain is what deals with the art, it deals with the mystery, it deals with the unknown. And so I feel like I was lucky enough to have enough experience of what it means to be in wilderness, which is that area where what you know ends and what you don't know begins on the other side of that line or that mountain or that hill. That experience enabled me to have some tiny sense of what the people that did those paintings were up against and what they were doing. Yeah.
Well, on that profound note, Eve
Ewing, I guess I better go.
We're going to leave it right there. Thank you so much for making some time for the Slow Baja podcast, and thank you very much. Hey, you guys know what to do. Please help us by subscribing, sharing, rating, all that stuff. And if you missed anything, you can find the links in the show notes at slowbaja.com. I'll be back before you know it. If you want to receive notices on new episodes, please follow Slow Baja on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for you old folks.